Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty are pieces of American mythology. Give me your poor, your tired, your humble masses. In the first two decades of the 20th century, this nation truly opened its doors and received annually more than 800,000 of Europe's refugees. And no questions were asked where they came from, or where they were coming, what was their faith, and what were their intentions. And then in the 1920s, this nation deliberately closed the door. Immigration was limited to 153,000 a year by the Johnson Immigration Act of 1924. We no longer wanted the poor, the tired, the masses. We no longer interested in the humble, semi-literate, Slav peasant who had only his dignity and his strength to recommend him. We wanted British businessmen and German engineers, middle-class people from backgrounds not unlike those which the establishment in America delighted to assume was its own. And of course, the tragedy of all of this, besides the restrictionism, the isolationism that it represents, is that America all but closed its doors to the refugee, to those who wanted our freedom, just a few years before the madness of Hitler spread over the world, just a few years before tens of millions of people needed an opportunity for freedom, for a new chance in life. In 1924, when the United States imposed these restrictions, there were less than 100 million people on this great continent of ours, in this great nation of ours. There was room, and we chose to close the doors. Now, unfortunately, as we look back on this era, one is moved to say, would that we had admitted in each of the years of the 1930, the 153,000 who were permitted. In actual fact, between 1933 and 1943, 1,244,000 visas which could have been granted to the refugees of Europe were not granted, because the immigration legislation of the 1920s was not only restrictive but racist. Of the 153,000 permissible applications annually, 83,000 visas had to be given to citizens of the British Isles. This country was to be and remain Anglo-Saxon and white and, if possible, Protestant. And so there were to be 83,000 annually from the British Isles, and fewer in those years leaving the British Isles. There could be only 5,000 a year from Poland, 1,000 a year from Hungary, 300 a year from Romania. And these quotas, which were never changed during this entire period of Hitler, consigned tens of thousands of people in the gas chambers. America was determined to maintain the purity of its way of life. And those who needed this freedom were looked upon as potentially subversive, as suspicious, unless they came from certain well-known similar parts of the world. We wanted them, if they were trained, well-to-do, if they had family here, if they had the major religion, and if they were white. Africa and Asia had literally no quota. But what is left to say is, when we rehearse the history of the 1930s, would that just the 70,000 refugees who were permitted under the immigration laws from the continent of Europe. Would that these 70,000 had been admitted in any one year to the United States? Germany, according to the legislation of 1924, was allowed 26,000 immigrants annually. During the 1930s and late 1920s, far more American citizens of German ancestry left this country to emigrate back to the Third Reich than German Aryans applied at the American consulates to emigrate to the United States. The fatherland had a great appeal, and the dream of conquest and of glory and of world dominion lured many back to Frankfurt and Berlin and Hamburg. Would that our consulates had understood what Hitler meant when he spoke of a Germany which was Judenrein, clean, erased of Jews. Would that they had allowed the Jewish refugees of Germany to fill up these unused places. But such was not to be the case. In no year between 1932 and 1938 did more than 5,000 German Jews receive admission into the United States under the immigration laws. Why? Because these laws were not only restrictive and they were not only racist, but equally they were applied by the bureaucracy with a stringency which can only be called cold-blooded when it was not steeped in prejudice. According to the administrative procedures required by the Immigration and Naturalization Services of the State Department, a potential immigrant to the United States had not only to prove that he was a fine citizen, that he was in good health. If he had been beaten by the Gestapo and his health had been ruined in the concentration camp, he was not a desirable alien for admission under these rules. He not only proved that he was in good health, but that he had a good bit of money to fall back on if he came to the United States. The potential immigrant had to prove that he would never become a public charge, and no one asked whether the Gestapo had stripped this German businessman or this German merchant, Jew, of whatever money the family had. He had to prove that he was of good character. He had to receive documents from the state which proved his citizenship. And if the state had already declared him stateless, as Germany did after the Nuremberg Laws in 1935, well, there was nothing our government can do. You had to have your documents of citizenship. And if he wanted to apply for entry into the United States, he had to go to the Gestapo, go to the German police, and receive a certificate from them in duplicate that he had no criminal record. And no differentiation was made if he had a criminal record, whether his crime was simply being a Jew, or simply being a political criminal, to be a social democrat, a reformer, opposed to Hitler, or whether he was in fact of the scum of the earth, one of the thieves or murderers of the German back alleys. Every kind of bureaucratic, administrative obstacle was put in the way those who sought in these desperate years for admission. There was a German physician, age 33. His wife was age 31. He was in good health. Both of them were. He had received his training at some of the finest medical institutions in Europe, which meant that he had had the finest medical training in the world. He applied for admission, for a visa to the United States. A sister, an uncle, and a friend in the United States signed affidavits. The physician and his wife had $1,600 left, which they had somehow hidden from the Nazis. His visa, her visa, were denied. The consulate in Hanover argued that there was no proof that the sister, the uncle, and the friend would live up to the terms of the affidavit. There was no legal claim by the man upon them. $1,600 was not enough to guarantee that this physician would not be a public charge. And let us remember that this consulate was acting in the terms of mid-1930s, at a time when the American Medical Association, like all the other professional bodies and craft unions, was seeing to it that no one who came to these shores could be allowed to enter into competition with them. The AMA set up a licensing procedure which precluded German doctors from practicing until they became citizens of the United States, which consigned them for 5 years to being unable to earn a living. And on what grounds? On the grounds that these men who had been trained in what was in those days the finest medical tradition in the world, by their practicing medicine in the United States, would somehow lower the level of health services to the American people. Behind all this specious rationalization was the simple statement of greed: I don't want another doctor coming into this city to compete with me. $153,000 were permitted. 70,000 could be brought in from continental Europe. Less than 25,000 came in during the middle years of the 1930s. There was Hitler, there was the Gestapo, there were the beginnings of the concentration camps. Jews were spit at, Jews were imprisoned arbitrarily, Jews were denied their rights, Jews were beaten on the street in daylight in the eyes of the police. In 1935, by the Nuremberg Laws, the Jews were denied their citizenship, protection of the law. In 1938, there was Kristallnacht, when on one April evening, every synagogue in Germany was set on fire. Jews were imprisoned in increasing numbers. Jews were murdered in increasing numbers. The world was not blind to what was happening. And in this nation, the Jewish community and men of goodwill who joined with them began as to build pressure on the government for some action, not simply words of greeting to some public affair, but action, admission of refugees, care for them, money for them. And finally, the administration felt that action was required. They had to take off the heat. President Roosevelt ordered the convening of an international conference on refugees at Evian in France. 32 nations came to this conference. While many of the rescue agencies said, finally something will be done. But the American delegate went to this conference convened by his own president to confront the problem of the refugees with these specific instructions. No new proposals are to be made by the American delegation for the care of refugees. And the British delegate went to this conference only on the condition that the immigration of Jews into Palestine was not to be an issue on the agenda. And within 6 months, the White Paper of 1939 had been imposed, which restricted further immigration of Jews into Palestine to a mere 10,000 a year. There were 13 million Jews in Europe. 600,000 in Germany, Austria, Sudeten had already become parts of the Third Reich, Poland was about to fall. But the issue of immigration of Jews into Palestine was not to be on the agenda. The empty continent of Australia had its representative say at Evian, we have no native racial antipathy and we don't intend to import one into Australia. The Latin American and South American countries said, we are homogeneous societies. We are Catholic and we are Spanish in origin and we don't want to bring in any divisive element into our midst. And the sum and substance of Evian was simply this. A few cables to our consulates in Germany by the State Department which read that certain administrative procedures were to be relaxed. A few more Jews were to be allowed to funnel into the United States. And the creation by the 32 nations of what was called an Intergovernmental Committee on Refugees, which had no money and which had no power and which in fact had no office, and became simply another administrative roadblock put in the way of all the rescue agencies, the volunteer private rescue agencies, which were trying to do a desperate and urgent piece of work. And then came the war. And during the early years of the war, the Nazis began to finally put in motion the machinery for the final solution to the Jewish problem, for genocide. The death camps were built, the ovens were fired, the engineers and chemists discovered the right amount of poisonous gas to bring into each oven at how long it took to murder how many tens of thousands of refugees. And the world continued as if genocide had not been decreed. Arthur Marsh has recently written a book called While 6 Million Died, in which he details the events of these early war years, in which he shows how, despite the mounting evidence of Nazi determination, the State Department refused to credit it. In fact, it ordered some of its agents abroad to cease to transmit this kind of information to the United States until it had absolute proof, and this is wartime when you didn't get this kind of proof, until they had seen with their own eyes and American consuls were not admitted into Poland, into the death camp areas. Documents were actually forged in order to preclude certain American citizens, Jewish groups, from having proof of the atrocities. And when groups, Jewish and non-Jewish, appealed to the State Department for corroboration of this incredible Nazi scheme, they were told that we're checking on it. We're not yet sure. Delay of all kinds. In April of 1943, the Swedish government proposed to the United States and to Great Britain they would seek from Germany the release of 20,000 Jewish children for which Sweden would be prepared to care on humanitarian grounds, provided that the Allied powers were willing to accept half the cost of this rescue operation and provided that the Allied powers would allow certain medicines and foodstuffs needed for the care of these youngsters through the blockade. The State Department of the United States did not answer this request from the Swedish government for 6 months. And when that answer came, it was simply to indicate that the Swedish government had misaddressed its request. It should have gone to the moribund Intergovernmental Committee on Refugees. In June of 1943, one of these tragic ships of refugees showed up in Norfolk Harbor. Almost 600 semi-starving men, women, and child were aboard, stateless people. They had escaped on the ship from Europe. They'd gone to Mexico. They'd been turned back from Mexico. They'd gone to Cuba. They'd been turned away from Cuba. And now they were in the land of the free. And the State Department was determined not to grant them asylum. It was not a question of admission, of citizenship. It was a question of simple asylum. And they were kept on the ship for days while pressure was brought on the American government. And finally, only the intercession of Eleanor Roosevelt was able to countermand the decision of the State Department not to grant that asylum. In 1943, Stalingrad had already taken place. It was clear that the tide of war was shifting on the side of the Allies. And the general who ruled Romania, Antonescu, saw the handwriting on the wall. He had already deported 200,000 of his Jews to the death camps, and he had deported others to various staging areas. But now he sent a communication to the Allies. If you will appoint a refugee center and provide for the transportation of these Jews, I'll let them go free. He wanted, of course, to build up his own defense for the war trials that he knew would come at the end of the war. This request was transmitted to Great Britain and to the United States. The State Department passed it from desk to desk to desk. Finally, some young man in the State Department had a brilliant idea. We don't have to make the negative decision. We'll turn it over to the Treasury, because the Treasury has control of all funds which are sent into the enemy camp. The Treasury will certainly turn down this scheme. But lo and behold, in 2 days, the Treasury, after they'd received this rescript, accepted the scheme and said, it's worthwhile, it must be done, it should be done now. And then there followed an incredible series of delays and obfuscations, of attempts to find some one or another agency within the government which would put the kibosh on this plan. 9 months passed. 9 months in which these people lived in near starvation. 9 months which drew ever closer the retreating German army and certain death. 9 months of delay. And finally, the men in the Treasury Department began to realize the unwillingness, and in fact, the prejudicial intent of the people who control these programs in the State Department. In January of 1944, 9 months after this project had been presented to the American government, members of the Treasury Department of the United States presented to Franklin Delano Roosevelt a document which they entitled On the Acquiescence of This Government in the Murder of the Jews. Let me read to you a few paragraphs from it. State Department officials have not only failed to use the governmental machinery at their disposal to recognize Jews from Hitler, but have even gone so far as to use this governmental machinery to prevent the rescue of those Jews. They have not only failed to cooperate with private organizations in the effort of these organizations to work out individual programs of their own, but have taken steps designed to prevent these programs from being put into effect. They have not only failed to facilitate the obtaining of information concerning Hitler's plans to exterminate the Jews of Europe, but in their official capacity have gone so far as to surreptitiously attempt to stop the obtaining of information concerning the murder of the Jewish population of Europe. They have tried to cover up their guilt by A, concealment and misrepresentation, B, the giving of false and misleading explanation for their failures to act and their attempts to prevent action, and C, the issuance of false and misleading statements concerning the action, in quotation marks, which they have taken to date. Now, this is not a reporter seeking a headline. This is one responsible agency of our government reacting to what they saw in another agency of our government. And this document was placed on Mr. Roosevelt's desk in 1944, was an election year. The war was coming to an end. The record would quickly be made available to many, and it was now necessary to take some deliberate steps. And 1944 marks a turning point in the reactions of our own government to the desperate plight of Jews and other refugees in Europe. A World Rescue Board was set in operation, staffed, interestingly, not by the State Department or by our career diplomats, but by the young men in the Treasury Department who had written this report. And it was quickly sent abroad, and it was given money, and it was given extraordinary powers, and tens of thousands of Jews and refugees of all kinds were saved in the last months of the war by their action. It's a fine record. It's part of American history. But 1944 is 1 year of need compared to the long years of Hitler and of the war and of need which preceded it, which are also part of the record. What shall we make of this American reality? This long, sad history of inaction, of obtuseness, of indifference, and of prejudice. Does it surprise us anymore that there is a credibility gap between the protestations of elected officials of the government and the performance of these same elected officials of government? It ought not to. During all this period, the Secretary of State, the President of the United States, was aghast whenever a delegation came to him with information about Nazi atrocities. But the emotion never carried over into action and decision. Because it did not, many an opportunity to rescue many a human being is overlooked, forgotten. What lesson shall we learn from all of this? The Zionists in the 1930s drew one lesson. The Zionists had not gone to Evian. They did not go to Bermuda. They understood quite clearly the difference between words and deeds. Dr. Silver, speaking to you some 3 years ago, said this: spiritual palsy attacked the world. A moving age found all sorts of excuses for doing nothing. There were transportation difficulties. There were immigration laws. There was a war on. Nowhere was there any appreciable exertion to rise above the quiddities of technicality and the barriers of routine. And so millions of our precious sons and daughters perished who might otherwise have been alive today. At the height of the war, the United States and England had convened a refugee conference in Bermuda. They were under pressure from their own parliaments and Congress, from sensitive people, to take some immediate action to bring Jews and others out from under the death sentence. The American delegation had gone to Bermuda with the following instructions. They were not to suggest that American immigration quotas were to be changed. They were not to suggest that ships which had brought supplies to Europe and were returning to the United States empty could be used to transport immigrants to the United States. They were not to suggest that the United States government was prepared to pay any degree of money for the care and feeding of these refugees, unless some mutually advantageous arrangement could be made out with the host country. They were to seek to find in Europe, and not in the United States, staging areas for the refugees. They were not to suggest that American patrol boats or destroyers were to accompany any refugee ships which might be on the high seas. They were not to raise the issue of Palestine and immigration into Palestine at this conference. These were the kinds of instructions brought by our government to a refugee conference in 1943. Spiritual palsy had indeed attacked the world. The United States is not without its full share of blame, Dr. Silver continued, for this terrible failure. Our country did not open its door wide to rescue the trapped men, women, and children. It did not offer even temporary asylum to them in numbers commensurate with the enormity of the tragedy. Actually, the number of visas which were granted was far below the quota allowed by immigration laws. America found it possible to transport and to admit to the United States more than 250,000 Nazi and fascist prisoners, and to give them domicile for the duration of the war. It did not find it possible to do so for Jews, who were its friendliest allies. I believe that much of the failure to achieve results on the part of the American Jewish organizations which concerned themselves with this problem was due to their lack of coordination, their working across purposes, their tardiness, and the political involvements of some of their leaders which kept them from exposing forcibly the do-nothing policy of the government. What Dr. Silver was saying then, as he said throughout his lifetime, is that there's quite a difference with coming to the President of the United States with a well-meant petition in your hand and coming into his office with votes in your pocket. It's one thing to look to the decency of men, another thing to count on that decency. The President is a decent man. During the 1930s, he was grappling with the Depression. There were millions of unemployed in the United States. He needed to be reelected. There was the nativist vote, the Daughters and Sons of the American Revolution, the American Legion, all kinds of patriotic societies determined to keep America pure. There were the labor unions on whom he counted for reelection, who were afraid of hunky labor, of competition. There were the professional societies who were particularly afraid of the professional Jew. And so we could always find, as good men of goodwill often find they are able to do, he could always find a rationalization, a justification for inaction. He ought to be reelected to keep America driving towards an international position. He ought to keep America concentrated on the war effort. It could not be diverted at the same time with our vast resource to do some kind of operation for the rescue of the Jew. And there have always been those who believe because they can have dinner with the President that somehow they affect the policy of the United States. Men and women who think that policy is changed by friendship. And they are more often than not, they get used rather than achieve their aims. We have an example of this in our own day, in this last 2 weeks. One of the men who's president of one of the major American Jewish organizations, which has been concerned with trying to get certain kinds of military hardware and other things that the United States government might sell to the Israeli. This very man had somehow his arm twisted and found himself leading a delegation of Jews to Vietnam in order to pull some of the American chestnuts out of the fire by creating a Jewish refugee concern in that part of the world. And what's happening today happened over and over and over again in the 1930s. Roosevelt had many Jewish friends and many important Jewish advisors, but he always found a way of turning aside their requests, of saying, I'm doing all that can be done. But was he? If you want to know why there's student power today, why there's black power today, why there's peace power today, here's the reason. Here's the reason. Men must be forced often to do that which they should do. It's always easy to find the rationalization for inaction. And in a democracy, a politician must find every justification to appeal to as many voting blacks as he can to guarantee his re-election. Between votes and morality, he'll say to you, I have to be re-elected to be effective. Between votes and morality, 25,000 Jews a year got into the United States in the middle years of the 1930s. Would that it operated differently. It's good that there is the American dream. It keeps our vision high. Often men are moved to do that which in self-interest they would not do. But the dream itself is not enough. And the American mythology is not the American reality. And if American Jews or American Negroes or peace-loving Americans or Americans who are concerned with civil rights are truly concerned with their movements, then they must move them along. And you don't do so by counseling gentility. You don't do so by counting up the number of words of goodwill which politicians have addressed to your organization at your annual banquet. It's tachlis. What have you got? What laws? What amendment to immigration rules? How are the laws being administered? What progress is being made? These are the questions. These are the measures. These are the tests. There's no reason for any of us to rake over the old coals unless we learn a lesson. The lesson, I'm afraid, is this. That in the world in which we live, morality must come wrapped in a fist. That you can't assume that sweet reason and gentle persuasion will achieve your end. It will educate the next generation. It will condition the environment in which you live. Thank God the American mythology is what it is. Our guilt is a guilt of inaction, not the German guilt of pathological murder, violence. We have a different ethos and a different world which gives us infinitely greater possibilities because of our mythology, because of our teachings, because of the reasonableness of our moral positions. And we have also bigots in this nation. We have also our share of the greedy. And we have far more of our share of those who refuse to look up from their workbench, from counting their money, to see the real and large-scale needs of the nation. When any group resorts to power, it courts failure, of course. It takes a path which increases the opprobrium of those who don't want to be reminded of their duty or of those who don't want their privilege to be stripped from them. It creates abrasion and a certain amount of disunity in the nation. This is the inevitable price of change. But if we want to avoid the repetition of the kind of sad record that this nation wrote in the 1930s and early 40s, as far as the refugee question is concerned, then I think all of us must learn to be far more understanding and tolerant of the impatient. The committed men and women feel, who know, their cause is just and urgent, and who will not be put off by the counsels of compromise, by the pious words, by the platform pledges, who insist that the politicians prove their allegiance and earn the vote that they are asking for on election day. We can argue about techniques. We can have our questions about certain kinds of public display. But it seems to me proven beyond any shadow of debate that unless the reformer is willing to get down into politics and slug it out, unless the Jew is willing to be a Zionist, committed, unless those who believe in civil liberties, civil rights, are willing to demand change now, the politicians, the administrators, will find every reason to delay, to continue things as they are. The damage multiplies. The number of children inadequately educated, the number of families inadequately housed, the number of people deprived of their vote, the number of immigrants not admitted to these shores, these case histories in human misery multiply. And ultimately the damage far exceeds the conflict and the abrasion of the moment. I'm proud of this nation. We've come a long way, very humble and semi-literate origins. We have a great tradition. But when this nation stumbles short of its glory, then I think it's incumbent upon all of us to look the facts squarely in the eye and to take to heart the lesson of our mistakes. It would be wrong to see the history of 1930 simply as another outbreak of American anti-Semitism. There was that in it. But it represents a case history and structural breakdown. It represented the good of the nation coming against political reality, but unwilling to enter into politics itself. Money, yes. But the pulpit shouldn't be in politics. Jewish rescue organizations shouldn't take stands. You remember the issues of the 30s. That's no longer an option open to us. If we want change, we need to fight for it. Fairly, within the law, then the range of possibilities offered to us. But we must stand up and be counted. And that I believe to be the lesson to be learned from this sad history. Amen.